Our reading today is taken from the book of Mark, chapter 5, reading from verse 21 to 43. Jesus raises a dead girl and heals a sick woman. When Jesus had again crossed over by boat to the other side of the lake, a large crowd gathered round him while he was by the lake. Then one of the synagogue leaders named Jairus came, and when he saw Jesus, he fell at his feet. He pleaded earnestly with him, "My little daughter is dying. Please come and put your hands on her so that she will be healed and live." So Jesus went with him. A large crowd followed and pressed round him. And a woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years. She had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors and had spent all she had. Yet instead of getting better, she grew worse. When she heard about Jesus, she came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak, because she thought, "If I just touch his clothes, I will be healed." Immediately her bleeding stopped, and she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. At once Jesus realised that power had gone out from him. He turned round in the crowd and asked, "Who touched my clothes?" "You see the people crowding against you," his disciples answered, "and yet you can ask, 'Who touched me?'" But Jesus kept looking round to see who had done it. Then the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell at his feet, and trembling with fear, told him the whole truth. He said to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering." While Jesus was still speaking, some people came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue leader. "Your daughter is dead," they said. "Why bother the teacher anymore?" Overhearing what they said, Jesus told him, "Don't be afraid, just believe." He didn't let anyone follow him, except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. When they came to the home of the synagogue leader, Jesus saw a commotion with people crying and wailing loudly. He went in and said to them, "Why is all this commotion and wailing? The child is not dead, but asleep." But they laughed at him. After he put them all out, he took the child's father and mother and the disciples who were with him and went in where the child was. He took her by the hand and said to her, "Talitha kum," which means, "Little girl, I say to you, get up." Immediately the girl stood up and began to walk around. She was 12 years old. At this, they were completely astonished, and he gave strict orders not to let anyone know about this, and told them to give her something to eat. Amen. Give thanks for this reading from God's holy word. To his name be glory and praise.
Meryl Streep won her second Oscar in 1982 for her role in Sophie's Choice, the screen adaptation of William Styron's novel. 40 years later, I hope it's not too much of a spoiler if I tell you that the choice in the title refers to the impossible decision forced on Streep's character by her Nazi captors to choose which of her two children should live and which should go to the gas chambers. It's an unimaginably cruel choice for a parent to be forced to make. In our reading today, it appears as though Jesus is faced with a similar sort of choice. Mark intertwines two stories. The outer story is of a synagogue official, Jairus, whose 12-year-old daughter lies dying. Jairus seeks out Jesus to lay hands on her and heal her. He appears as a desperate parent, falling at Jesus' feet, gladly abasing himself before this travelling prophet because he will do anything in his power, and his power is considerable, to save the daughter he loves. The inner story is of another nameless woman who has been ill for 12 years. Equally desperate, she also falls at Jesus' feet, initially though only to touch the hem of his garment secretly. So which of these should Jesus help? Of course, we know the ending, so we know he helps them both. But in the heat of the story, it looks as though Jesus has a choice to make. At least that's how Mark builds the tension. Jesus is on his way to Jairus' house, where his daughter is on the point of death. But the tension builds as Jesus stops to listen to the story of the other woman. In preparation for this sermon, I read and listened to about 7 or 8 sermons to hear how others retell the story. And every one of those preachers imagined Jairus tapping his feet anxiously, achingly, while Jesus wastes time as the inner story drags on. Mark himself, however, offers us no such glimpse inside Jairus' mind. He only reports the bald fact that in the time it took Jesus to listen to the whole story the woman has to tell him, the girl actually dies. So you be the jury. Who should Jesus have helped first? And before you think this is just a little game I'm playing with you, you might want to reflect on the fact that this is precisely the choice healthcare professionals have to make every day. Who needs our help first? But it's also the choice facing governments and local authorities every time they draw up a budget. And the choice countries face when they consider their foreign aid spending. And company executives face when considering staff raises or corporate social responsibility funding. And you and I face such choices every time we receive a polling card through the door, and every time we make a decision to shop here or to shop there. Who should receive the next COVID vaccine first? The old or the young? One profession or another? Local or overseas? These are tough choices, but they must be made because there's not enough to go around. We live in a world of scarcity, subject to the myth of scarcity. And according to the myth of scarcity, there is always the fear that the good things will run out before we get to the front of the queue. And such fear drives us, so far as we have the power to do so, to make sure at least we are taken care of before we turn our attention to helping others. Some will get help and some will not. One child to the labor camp, the other to the gas chamber. In the case of the two characters in Mark chapter 5, there are all sorts of reasons why Jesus should help the young girl first. She is, after all, on the point of death, whereas the woman has been ill for many years. The woman's illness might be chronic, but she's not going to die from it anytime soon. Well, she can go on suffering for another 12 years for all we care. She'll still be around to heal later. Moreover, there is more hope to come. More hope to come from the girl. The woman has been bleeding for 12 years. At the very least, we can say that she has therefore been reproductively unfruitful for those years and is now probably beyond childbearing age anyway. The girl, by contrast, is just about to hit puberty. So much to hope for. If she lives, she will be able to marry and produce many children. But there's more. See, the girl is the daughter of Jairus, a synagogue official, an important man, a wealthy man, a powerful man, who has servants to bring him news of his daughter's death, and crowds gathered outside his home to help him mourn. The woman is nobody. Ritually unclean for 12 years, she's been excluded from temple life and probably much of community life too. She's nothing more than a nameless member of the pressing throng. And our civilization, if one can call it that, leaves us in no doubt as to which life is more valuable than another. Men are more valuable than women. Whites are more valuable than blacks. Those from the first world are more valuable than those from the third world. The clue is in the names we give them. The rich are more valuable than the poor. Celebrities are more valuable than the unknown, and on and on and on. And yes, I know, we've all become so woke that nobody still believes such nonsense. Certainly, no one would hold it as a doctrine. And yet, who actually gets the help first? And yet, has the victory of capitalism over communism not established once and for all as a universal truth that when you ensure the rights and freedoms of the wealthy few, everybody benefits through the trickle-down effect? As long as the wealthy are looked after first, they will be in the best possible position to give the rest of us the scraps from their tables. Everybody wins, right? So what does Jesus do? Jesus makes two movements that are both intriguing and in some ways revolutionary. First, he touches the untouchable. In fact, he does so twice. When the woman of great faith touches the hem of his garment, she effectively passes on her ritual impurity to him. The fact that she bleeds makes her ritually unclean, and anyone coming into contact with her is made unclean by her. If Jesus had only held his tongue, nobody would have known or bothered. But he stops, acknowledges her, listens to her story, her whole truth. I wonder how the pressing crowds reacted. Her presence among them, all pressing together, would have rendered them all unclean. Jesus acknowledges the touch and heals her, not only secretly of her disease, but also publicly of her shame. Daughter, he says. You see, Jairus is not the only one who has a beloved daughter in this story. Your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease. When he gets to Jairus' house, Jesus will again touch the untouchable. You see, dead bodies were also ritually unclean, but Jesus doesn't shrink back. He reaches out for the girl's hand and wakes her from her death. And in it all, Jesus does a second, most startling thing. He behaves as if there is no scarcity after all, but rather an abundance of healing. Do not fear, only believe, he tells the grieving father. But the time is spent, the healing is spent, the old woman lives and the child is dead. Jairus' worst fears have been realized. There wasn't enough to go around, and his power and wealth didn't buy him a better place in the queue. Do not be afraid. Only believe. Imagine saying that to the leaders of the G7 countries. Don't be afraid, only believe. Believe that after you have sent meaningful aid to lift the poorest in the world from their poverty, there will still be enough money left for you to defend your borders. Imagine saying that to the people of the wealthy West. Don't be afraid, only believe. Believe that after you have written off the debts of the third world, you will still have enough wealth to live in comfortable security. Imagine saying to the British taxpayer, don't be afraid, only believe. Believe that after you have housed the homeless, fed the hungry, and welcomed the refugee, you will still live in a country that you can be proud of. Craziness? Perhaps. Idealism? Maybe. But Jesus acts as if he believes in God's abundance rather than in the myth of scarcity. Commentator Mark Davis concludes as follows. I would argue that for Mark, not just the intertwining, but the order of these stories is important. The need of the daughter of privilege yields to the need of the impoverished, unclean daughter of suffering. That is not how the myth of scarcity usually works. The young one has everything to live for, while the older one is much further along the road. That's what appeases our conscience about choosing one over the other. How radical, then, that Jesus interrupts helping Jairus' daughter, a fatal decision, it turns out, to be in impure solidarity with the bleeding woman, also a daughter, whose fierce faith and desperation drives her. Solidarity with the suffering, even at the price of becoming ritually impure, is the cost of overcoming the myth of scarcity.